Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left at Capital Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francie.
How are you, Mark?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
I'm great. You know, my dad was a fireman, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we used to go, a lot of the firemen and cops from Orange, New Jersey would, you know, they do stuff together. The kids, you know, they would, you know, for instance, very often, my dad with some of the other firemen and you know, some of the cops who were friends of his, we'd go fishing.
Fishing is fun.
Yeah, and, like, they'd take the kids fishing. It was a real popular thing, you know, blue-collar family, mm-hmm. You know, so my dad used to go fishing all the time. A lot of the cops in Orange used to go fishing all
the time.
And
remember, in Jersey we say fishing.
Yeah,
okay?
Fishing.
We don't go fishing.
We go down the shore.
We go fishing.
And we go fishing. We don't go to the shore. We're not at the shore. We're down the shore. We go fishing.
You got a little bit of Jerseyana for us today?
In Connecticut, there's an officer named Joseph Gambardella who also likes to go fishing. See, lobsters in particular. Sadly, he likes to fish them out of restaurants' freezers. I love this.
This was a great story. Please tell our listeners this story.
Dateline New Haven. One night in October, a police officer in Madison, a small coastal Connecticut town, called into dispatchers telling them that he noticed a door to a restaurant had been left ajar. Don't worry, he said. He'll check it out. So he goes in there.
And checked it out, baby. He checked it out.
And I don't know whether the door was ajar at all, because it turns out that they had cameras on, you see, to look for employee theft because some lobster had been missing from their freezer. Well, they get a picture of the officer going into the restaurant with a plastic bag.
And filling it up.
Rummaging through some bins.
It's beautiful.
Going into the freezer, filling it up with lobster meat and shrimp, and then emerging. Here, I have the quote. Hold on a second.
Hold on. And remember, this is a police officer.
Right. On duty.
Yeah.
With a squad car. Instead, the camera captured Officer Gambardella heading for the cooler and, according to the affidavit, emerging with, and I quote, an expanded and weighed down trash bag. Then, check this out, of all the unmitigated gall, he appears to be talking to the alarm security company.
Everything's okay here.
You ready for this? Not only is he... I love, this is the best. This is like out of Beretta, right? Not only is he talking to the alarm security company, he's talking to the alarm company using a white towel to cover the receiver. So the guy breaks in or finds an open door and goes in on a couple of occasions. This must be a very careless restaurant, leaving that door open all the time. Then goes and steals the lobster. The alarm company calls after he trips the alarm. And he's like, "God, this is Officer Gambardella. It seems to be, the door must have blown open. Everything's okay here." I love this.
I came in and it appears there are some lobster missing. There's definitely some lobster missing.
The officer is accused of taking 21 bags of lobster meat worth $44 each, so we're not talking about small change, and 2 bags of shrimp which cost $18.60 each. This is a quote from Hugh F. Keefe, his defense attorney. The tape seems damaging. Yes. Mr. Keefe went to law school to figure that one out.
Well, you know the defense there.
Oh, no, he says, of course we have a defense. He pled not guilty.
He pled not guilty. He's throwing the garbage out. That's all.
Those lobsters looked dangerous.
They were... I swear, the lobster on the right had a gun.
Yes, the lobster was coming to get me. Anyway, I'll tell you.
It was self-defense.
I tell you, I think that, you know, I mean, I come from a long line of Irish cops and firemen. The police in New Brunswick are tremendous and have been tremendous to us. But, you know, when you see a cop go and do something like that, it just, you know, it disparages what happens, you know, to all the other cops that are honest.
You say the police in New Brunswick are tremendous, you mean they've never walked into our walk-in box and stole the lobsters. That's what you mean.
That's barely acceptable. They're well above barely acceptable. But, no, they've never stolen anything from us as far as
unbelievable.
I tell you, there is that one thing in the restaurant, though, that the police really, we had a little trouble with when we first began. There were two funny stories. One, the one funny story is We had a wireless panic button installed because we used to have the waiters at the end of the night at 2 o'clock in the morning, and New Brunswick didn't used to be as nice and safe and clean a city as it is. So it was a little dangerous having your waiters out there on the street bringing in the sidewalk cafe at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning.
So they would have a panic button that they'd put in their pocket or on their belt buckle, and they could immediately alert the police if something happened at 3 o'clock in the morning while they were putting away the outdoor cafe.
Well, they would occasionally like hit something in their pocket, and that panic button would go off. Happened like 3 times. We got rid of that panic button.
The police hate when you press the hold up panic button, and it's because you're putting the tables away.
Right. Well, because the panic button doesn't go off. A silent alarm gets sent to the station, and it's a hold up alarm. So they come in with their guns drawn, scared the hell out of our bartender, right? And they were
like, "Am I being arrested?"
And they're like, "Listen. You guys do that again, we're going to start finding you." It was the police said. Mm-hmm. So we had it taken out. And we now have a stationary panic button, and we can't tell you what button. And we have cameras, and we have a panic button, and we're all adults now. But our experiences in New Brunswick have been great. But I want to broaden our discussion a little bit to a victory. We want to update you on a victory that we've had in this state.
Yeah, sure. A show we had, it's got to be almost a year ago now.
A woman named Maya Van Rossum, who is the Delaware Riverkeeper, and that's an actual post. And she's in charge of environment for the Delaware. The Delaware is a very important river to Pennsylvania and to New Jersey, and well,
and of course New York,
and of course Delaware would be very important. There was a proposal, and there are threats to it all the time, and people work. There are a lot of people like Maya Van Rossum works very hard to keep it clean and safe and keep the habitat protected.
Frankly, it's important to the whole tri-state ecosystem. I mean, mm-hmm. it's one of the most important waterways of the area.
Well, there was this dumb plan to bring, there's VX nerve gas that needs to be treated and neutralized and then dealt with somewhere. It is I forget where it is, but it's in the
Indiana.
It's in the middle of the country, I was going to say. On a military base right now, and it needs to be neutralized. There are ways to neutralize it there, but DuPont had made a bid to have it brought to their Deepwater, New Jersey site called the Chambers Works, and they were going to have it...
They were going to treat it.
Well, no. First of all, they were going to have VX nerve gas trucked across the country.
Right. Okay? Seems like a bad idea.
In an age of terrorism, I don't know that that's the best idea. You know, now that's a heck of an accident if you get an accident. And then they were going to treat it... and then at the Chambers Works from DuPont, and then release the treated. This is one of the most dangerous chemicals to life on the planet. They're going to release it into the Delaware.
Well, the treated VX is still caustic, but it's they talk about it being caustic like cleaning supplies are caustic.
So we should dump that in the river.
So, but there's 1,200 tons of this stuff that they were going to cart from Indiana.
A little at a time, nobody will notice.
From Indiana to New Jersey, then they were going to treat it. Then they were going to dump it in the Delaware.
You put a gallon a day in the Delaware, and then 10,000 years from now, it's all taken care of. Okay. So this dumb idea was finally stopped, and I think largely thanks to the work of a lot of people, but Maya Van Rossum became on our show to talk about it, and we know that a lot of emails and mails were generated from you guys, but DuPont has decided to not do it. Governor Corzine said in a statement, it's official, VX will never be dumped in the Delaware River or any other New Jersey waterway. It's a decisive victory for the people of New Jersey. VX nerve agent is one of the world's most deadly chemical compounds. Dumping it in the river never made any sense, and it still doesn't. And he gave a lot of credit to Robert Andrews and the New Jersey congressional delegation for making sure that, that didn't happen. So we're thrilled to have no VX nerve gas in the river. We're going to have fish for lunch.
I think it's a great idea.
To celebrate.
There's just one quote in here that I have to read from the DuPont lawyer, and it reads, "During our three
hold on a second, I'm not going to like this, am I?
During our 3-year evaluation of the Newport proposal, it's become increasingly clear to us that the lengthy approval process, that the approval process will be lengthy and arduous. Therefore, we believe it's in the best interest of New Jersey and DuPont not to proceed."
Yeah. In the best interest of New Jersey.
In other words, it's going to cost a lot of money. We're not doing it.
We tried to shove this down your throat so hard, and it didn't work. So now we've decided to leave, is what he said.
We're going to back off.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Peter Meehan. Peter is one of our favorite food writers, among other food and wine pursuits. Freelance, he writes the 25 and under column for the New York Times. That makes him a bit of a food adventurer and investigative reporter. You've heard us refer to his articles and talk about them on this show before. How I Learned to Cook, Culinary Educations from the Wine World's Greatest Chefs is full of insights. It's a book he co-wrote with a woman named Kimberly Witherspoon. It's full of insightful and entertaining answers to the very question from chefs like Mario Batali and Anthony Bourdain to Daniel Boulud and Ferran Adrià.
Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Peter, this book, How I Learned to Cook, is basically you posed this very question to 40 of the best chefs in the world. Is that how it works?
We did. Kim Witherspoon, who I co-edited the book with, had done a previous book called Don't Try This at Home, Culinary Catastrophes from the World's Greatest Chefs. It was a hit. They wanted to do a follow-up, and Kim came up with the idea of How I Learned to Cook as an interesting, you know, as a way to solicit interesting stories from chefs. So we went to them with it, and it was interesting. When you ask a chef, when you ask someone who cooks, you know, 14 hours a day or has cooked 14 hours a day for a large portion of their life, how they learn to reduce it down to a story, they're initially dumbfounded and think they have no way of telling you that story. But you know, I think in the 40 essays we've got here, we've got a lot of different and very personal responses to that question.
Did you find that there was a commonality, or did they all seem to come from diverse backgrounds?
There were stories that multiple chefs, in talking about what was going to go into the book, in the last book, in Don't Try This at Home, there was a story about making mashed potatoes. They're not creamy enough. You put them in the food processor, they turn into book paste. that seems to be a mistake that a lot of people have made at different times, and usually at, you know, bad times right before service when you really need those creamy mashed potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, ultimately, I think that we got a pretty diverse range of stories, though they all do share some common elements. There's a lot of perseverance through situations that you know, electrocutions and getting scalded and yelled at.
You're gonna have to back that one up a little bit, Peter. because you know, most people don't think of electrocutions as part of a culinary career, but you have a story of an electrocution.
We have Eric Repaire, when he was stodging as a 15-year-old in the south of France.
And Eric Repaire is now the chef at Le Bernardin.
At Le Bernardin, one of the most respected chefs, 4 stars, 3 Michelin stars, in New York. He had kind of this series of misfortunes at a restaurant with this incredibly violent and aggressive chef, and his story builds and builds as he makes mistakes and gets threatened and is trying to get it together in the kitchen. And one afternoon, after he's frozen 50 duck breasts together and he's in trouble with the chef, his punishment is he has to clean the salamander, the broiler at the restaurant, which is just caked in grease. And he's told just to do it with a rag, no cleaning, you know, fluids, no water, just, you know, elbow grease. Of course, as soon as the chef leaves, he soaks the thing. When the chef comes back in, he's surprised to see how quickly Repaire finished cleaning it. And when he goes over to test it, Repaire forgot that it was an electric broiler.
Oh, water and electric broiler.
Yeah, ends up nearly killing the chef. And so, but, you know, he learned from misbehaving and making so many careless mistakes in the kitchen that he needed to be more careful and more attentive to what he was doing if he wanted to be taken seriously as a cook. So
after you nearly electrocute the chef, is he meaner to you or nicer to you afterwards?
I think he was weakened at that point, so he couldn't come after Repaire.
His pacemaker never kept up.
Yeah,
after
exactly.
after that episode. When your book, one of the common themes you talk about is the passion that each of these people have. And you know, Mark and I have always said to people, I do a lot of restaurant consulting, and we say to people, often people have some money to invest and they want to get into the restaurant business as more than just an investor, and we say, listen, only do this if you have to, if you can't do anything else, if it's your passion. Your book is populated with some people who knew that they wanted to cook from the time they were 5.
Sure, Eric Repaire.
And some people who sort of stumbled into the profession, but then once in it found that it was what they needed to do. Is there a correlation there? I mean, what is the commonality of passion there? I mean, how do people accidentally find themselves in this job?
You know, I mean, that was, I think, one of the things that I enjoyed finding out in putting together this collection were the diverse paths people took to the kitchen, because you do have your your Eric Ripert's who know from an early age that they want to be the chef. You know, this is their life dream. But take Chris Schlesinger, who's been, you know, a trailblazer in Boston for 25 years. He was unemployed, you know, a summer after he had dropped out of college, hanging out in Virginia Beach, and got scolded out of his grandparents' house to a restaurant where the staff had just walked out, washed dishes that night, and found out you got to drink beer and hang out with girls and, you know.
These are a few of my favorite things.
Still,
and that was the enticement, and then it was, you know, to work in restaurants. And then over time, he slowly found that there was more to restaurants than beer and girls, and nothing else in his life that he wanted to do, like pursuing serious, real cooking. So I think that's one of the great things about this collection of stories is that you see it's not always someone who's always dreamed of being a chef. Sometimes it's people who stumbled into the kitchen and just found that was their place in the world.
I stumbled into a kitchen, and I quickly stumbled out to the front of the house.
Yeah, front of the house is where we belong.
Yeah, and I belong at the dining table. That's
why. And you belong writing about it later. Our guest is Peter Meehan. He's the author of a book, the co-author of a book, How I Learned to Cook, Culinary Education from the World's Greatest Chefs. And he's also author of the 25 and Under column for the New York Times. We'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on Nine is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on Nine supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on Nine has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on Nine, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. Our guest today is Peter Meehan. Peter has written a book called How I Learned to Cook. It's a collection of from 40 chefs of how they learned to cook. Peter, this book is funny. It's really funny. Did you did the chefs sort of just take it in that direction, or did you ask them to be funny?
You know, some chefs required some buttering up, but
I get it, chef butter up. Yeah.
But you know, some guys came right out of the gate. You know, Jimmy Bradley's story, which I think has a lot of incidental humor in it. You know, when I asked him for the story, he just rattled this thing off. He's a great storyteller, and I think he did a good job of telling a funny story. So, and other people, once we coaxed them a little bit, they were comfortable stepping back from themselves and laughing at the situation.
One of the things that I think is interesting about chefs, and everybody kind of sees chefs these days as these rock star personalities, but some chefs are fairly quiet and reserved, and I think probably a little tougher to pull out of their shell. Did you find that?
Sure. I mean, I think once we had earned their trust, that they knew we wanted to get a good story from them, they all, you know, everyone in this book had a good story to share.
Let me throw something out there. I thought an interesting inclusion in the book, which made a lot of sense to me from a literary perspective, but I thought was very interesting, is Anthony Bourdain, who wrote Kitchen Confidential, and, of course, who's celebrity chef on television. Even Anthony Bourdain, in his own book, says he's not one of the best chefs in the world. He likens himself in his own book to a second tier of chefs. Why did you include him in this?
Because if you can get Anthony Bourdain to put a story in your book, you do.
Yeah, but he is the best storyteller in the culinary world.
Yeah, he's the best storytelling chef, you know, in the business right now. So doing the book without Bourdain would have been a major loss.
Well, not to mention the fact he's just fun to talk to.
And he is. And, you know, and that was one of the things that I think it was partially my influence, and I think Kim, my co-editor, was very into it, was bringing a slightly wider range of chefs into it. You know, we have an Italian chef, we have a French chef, we have UK, so we have a little bit of European representation. And then Charles Phan, who cooks Vietnamese food in San Francisco, David Chang, who, when we were putting this book together, was not, you know, the media titan that he is now. But bringing a more diverse, Chris Bianco, the pizzaiolo in Phoenix, these guys have a, you know, they cook a wider range of food than I felt like would add more diversity to the stories in the book.
When we come back after the news, we're going to be talking more with Peter Meehan about his conversations with 40 of the best chefs in the world and how they learn to cook, and you can have some insights for you as well. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today our guest is Peter Meehan. Peter's one of our favorite food writers. He writes the 25 and Under column for the New York Times, which you hear us talk about all the time, but he's also written a book together with Kimberly Witherspoon. He's written How I Learned to Cook, Culinary Educations from the World's Greatest Chefs, which is where they ask 40 of the world's greatest chefs to answer that very question, how I learned to cook. One of the things, Peter, that I thought was great in here was you have a quote, Ferran Adrià, where you're quoting Ferran Adrià, who is quoting another chef that he took great inspiration from, a guy named Jacques Maximin, who says creativity, he learned that creativity was not copying. Talk to us about that.
Creativity is not copying. Well, I mean, I think in terms of Ferran Adrià, that's a very important point for him to make, because he went, you know, he came to the kitchen again for money and made himself into an incredibly proficient chef, but then he got to the point where he decided for himself it wasn't enough to be proficient, it wasn't enough to be a talented chef. For him, he had to start to create, because just cooking classic dishes and doing excellent renditions of them wasn't enough for him.
Good.
I mean, much like we see, you know, certain artists throughout history kind of change the face of artwork. We see Ferran Adrià kind of creating his own style that you know all these disciples are kind of coming from.
But don't you think that all of these chefs, in a way, I mean, look, Ella Fitzgerald heard Billie Holiday sing, you know, "The Man I Love," and then Ella sings it. It's not just doing the same thing again. It is bringing creativity to bear. How important is creativity to these guys?
I think a lot of them, because cooking is such tough work, and because in and out it's such a grind, it might not be the first thing, you know, out of their mouths that they prize the creativity that they get to have being successful proprietors of their own business. But I think that each one of them, the things that make them distinct, unique, the reasons we asked them to contribute to the book was because they've created a niche for themselves in this incredibly, incredibly competitive world, you know, that is professional cooking.
Do you find that there was, and as I read through many of the accountings of the chef, of the various chefs, that there is something that was reflected in many of what they wrote, something that we find, which is there's a tension, I think, in a great kitchen to be creative, but also to be very, very rigorous. I mean, and you talk a lot about, I think you quote Jose Andres, who is the chef at Jaleo and Cafe Atlantico and mini bar at Cafe Atlantico, where he talks about his father used to make him make the fire, and his father would stir the paella. And he talks about, you have a quote, he learned that every inglorious step is important in the process, you know, from the cleaning up to the prep. Did you find that with a lot of the authors, with a lot of the chefs?
I think part of the illusion that people are sold on that makes them think that they want to go and spend outrageous amounts of money at culinary school and open poorly thought out restaurants all over the country is that it's a very easy, creative business, that you come up with these dishes and then you serve them. Gabrielle Hamilton, who's, you know, very respected chef who had a restaurant Prune here, her story addresses that exactly. She would just come in and change the menu every day, and her entire kitchen wanted to kill her, you know, day in and day out because all the prep changed. And I think one of the things that many of these stories address is that it is a repetitive business. It is the inglorious work that makes glorious food.
Well, let's bring this. Can we briefly talk about your work with the Times? Because I think there's a relevant point to be made here. You go out and you find the restaurants off the beaten path, and you find, you know, in one of the greatest culinary cities in the world. I mean, you write about some interesting stuff, and you know, you just made a reference to people who start restaurants, whether they're well conceived or poorly conceived. Do you find lessons in your book for people who do start restaurants, have a more humble background like the ones you review in the 25 and Under column?
I mean, I think that a lot of the lessons that the chefs in the book share are universal to kitchens. I mean, it happened to somebody who's now, you know, you might see on TV, who might be a big name, you know, have Michelin stars, but they all had to go through the same hazing. They all had to, you know, how many onions have they chopped? I think it's one of the things that makes them great, that make all of these chefs great, is that they came up through this system and they paid their dues doing it.
But that's
in the best of ethnic restaurants. It's not, you know, or restaurants that I, you know, more humble restaurants that I might review for the 25 and Under for the Times. In the best of them, I think it's the same thing, and I think you can see that ability to execute dishes consistently and repeatedly and quickly. You know, I mean, I think there are a lot of parallels there.
Well, but that basic system is so important because it is where you learn your basic skills. It's where you set the foundation for all the other things from which to build. And also, I think that sometimes, just to get to your other point, I think that sometimes when you have a lot of these, a lot of the 25 and Under columns that you're talking about, I think from my perspective, what I've seen in people in those places, a lot of times it is a family tradition that someone's following or some kind of something that's from their background that pushes them towards that, maybe more than just this crazy desire to open a 4-star restaurant for some of the chefs in this book. Did you find that as well?
Sure, absolutely. And I think, you know, and I think some of the people who open, you know, 25 and Under restaurants like Dave Chang, who's in this book, you know, they came from a kitchen background. They actually learned these skills, but they didn't see, you know, they didn't see a path for themselves. They weren't going to be the next sous chef at Danielle. They weren't going to be the next. So they've taken what they've learned, as much as they've learned, as well as they've learned it, and applied it to a concept of their own that they feel comfortable in. And for some of them, you know, it ends up turning into something that'll put them in a book like this. I mean, both Gabrielle Hamilton and Dave Chang had their restaurants in 25 and Under before they went on to get awards and stars and turn into, you know, celebrity chefs.
Right, superstar chefs.
Well, let's talk not specific about the 25 and Under column, but I think what's interesting is you're an author, we're restaurateurs, we get to, we have friends who review and will occasionally go out with and review with people, which is kind of cool to be on the other side of the table. And we also get hired as consultants a lot, and very often we get hired when things are going awry to put them right, you know.
Sure.
One of the things that I want to ask you about from your perspective, because you do get to taste out and eat out so broadly, when people start restaurants on a shoestring, is there a unifying theme or are there specific things that people tend to really get wrong?
I'll say I eat a lot of bad meals out, and to generalize about what people get wrong would be, people get everything wrong fairly consistently. But I think there, you know, when you go to a place, even if they are not getting everything right yet, or maybe they may not, you know, ever have their front of house service program together in the way that we think of, you know, front of the house service can be, you know, the kind of Danny Meyer hospitality school. Some smaller restaurants are never going to have that, but there's a heart, you know, to them. There's a drive, and you can tell that there's someone in the kitchen sweating over every plate.
Mm.
hopefully not sweating over every plate.
Well,
but really watching it as, you know, maybe, really caring about every dish that's going.
That was an unfortunate analogy for a writer. Maybe sweating next to every
plate. Yeah, not sweating into every plate, at least, at the very least. So.
We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Peter Meehan about his book, How I Learned to Cook, and the state of restaurants in general. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the culture of the kitchen. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:44.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagut and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Our guest today is Peter Meehan. We're talking about how his book, How I Learned to Cook, which is a collection from 40 of the world's greatest chefs of how they learned to cook. I was really struck by a lot of the American chefs and people who wrote about cooking in the 80s and the culture, the various cultures of the kitchen. Can you talk to us about some of the people who maybe had difficulty with some of the less disciplined line cooks in the 80s and a culture that, you know, frankly, there's a lot of alcohol.
It's a late night culture. It's a
and
very
in the 80s there were a lot of drugs in
very emotionally charged culture. There's a lot of things that can happen.
Jonathan Eisman's story, which may be a little bit too blue to recount on the radio. It deals with, he was young grad out of CIA, talented, ambitious, and he said his job at the restaurant he was cooking at, which he does not name, in the West Village in the 80s, was managing the drug problems that his other coworkers had.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing at what point the people on which drugs were going to fall completely out of use during service. And that was, you know, he said, you know, in culinary school you learn so much technical stuff. You learn your sauce espanol, you learn, you know, what have you. And then you get thrown out into the real world, and you actually have to deal with, you know, that culture that I think Anthony Bourdain did such a brilliant job.
You're on cocaine. You work the line. You're on heroin. Off the line.
Exactly.
It's funny, but I can tell a little bit about the book. He finds Jonathan Eisman finds one of his line cooks in the middle of a busy night, smoking crack in the men's room, and. And that's really not allowed in the middle of a ship. It's definitely against company policy. But what's funny is, you know, the perils and pitfalls of people who live at night, especially young people who live at night, and, you know, people who work in the kitchen are people who live on adrenaline. And I really do think that the culture of the kitchen has gotten a lot more civilized in the last 10 or 15 years. But I do remember, I'll share with one story that I'll bring hard to Mark when I remember it. I did have one time guy was a sous chef of ours for a very short time, and I was like, where is the sous chef? And he worked for us very briefly, and I went down and I opened the walk-in downstairs, and it was like that Cheech and Chong movie. You know? He must have been smoking so much pot so fast.
And out the smoke billowed.
And I was like, hi. You're fired. But I will say that the smoked meats that were hanging in the walk-in
We had a smoked duck that was one of the most popular dishes on our menu.
had a certain je ne sais quoi. As we say in New Jersey, there's a certain je ne sais quoi, and I don't know exactly what it is. What do you think was the most interesting story? And, you know, I don't mean to make you pick among your children, give you a Sophie's choice here, but of these stories, which do you think was the most compelling for your young person looking to get into the restaurant business today of these 40 stories?
I have a lot of favorites in the book. I think Chris Bianco, who's the pizzaiolo at Pizzeria Bianco in Phoenix, where widely considered to be the best pizza in America,
mm-hmm.
His story of of going to Italy with his family on vacation when he was 18 or 19, I think, high school dropout, just working in a pizzeria and a tire shop. And he goes and sits down at this meal in, at a family friend's house in Friuli, and they pull the white asparagus out of the ground, boil it in a pot over a Sterno burner at the end of the table. You dump it out, hard-boiled eggs over it or soft-boiled eggs over it, olive oil, salt, and pepper. And just the connection that he had at that moment, saying, you know, this is the food from this earth, this is how they eat it, this simply, it was the revelation that sent him back to America and put him on the path to open a very seasonal, very simple, very direct, and now very beloved restaurant in Phoenix. So I think that, you know, I think that that was a great inspirational story. But again, picking favorites from the book, I think there were a lot of great lessons to be learned.
In the Chris Bianco story, there's a quote that says, eating isn't just always about looking for another meal to top the last one. And I think that's really great, because there's an idea in food and wine often, especially in wine with its 100-point scale, that food and wine is somehow a contest. When it's not really a contest, you know, it's like, you know, you don't rate the works of art in a museum, you look at them all. I mean, once you achieve a level of proficiency, what is your take on that? I mean, you're a food critic, right? But you're also a food journalist. Talk to us about that.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, I think the context that Chris brought that up in was saying that growing up Italian-American, even if he didn't care about food, he knew, you know, Mrs. Annunziata's got the best baked ziti kind of thing. And what he came away after that meal in Friuli and the philosophy he's taught now is that there's so much more to putting together a meal than just impressing or blowing somebody's socks off. You know, he's very into seasonal cooking. And, when I get to choose what I want to eat, that's important to me. He's into simple and direct flavors. You know, he says, brown food can be brown. You don't need to, you know, splatter the plate with raspberry coulis to dress it up.
Or chives on a fruit dish because it needs some green.
So I should throw those squeeze bottles away.
You know, and I think that's dealing with, you know, the fact that food and restaurant meals are sustenance and are a connection or can be a connection to the landscape that's around you. You know, it's a noble goal, and if you can make it happen, you know, in your restaurant, I think it tends to work out well for
people. And I think there are people in this industry who really do make that happen, and a lot of them are noted in your book.
Here's a parting shot question, and we only have about a minute, but this book today was written about a bunch of guys who were children in the 60s and 70s, maybe the 50s in some cases.
Sure.
Our culinary culture has changed, and our agriculture has changed. If somebody writes this book 25 years from now about the chefs who are then at the top, how is this book going to be different? Do you have any predictions?
Wow. Well, I mean, I think one of the things you'll see that will be different is that the wanton abuse of apprentices will be slightly less, but probably still there. And you know, if I can hope, you know, that this movement towards seasonal and local and sustainable agriculture will have taken an even deeper root with you know, the chefs that are going to be shaping the dining landscape.
Boy, you said the right thing for this show, huh? We agree with you, and our sincere hope is that all of the farms haven't been picked up to build a mall growing hydroponic vegetables.
And, you know, you talk about the wanton abuse, but, you know, I'm not big into abuse, but sometimes the hard road is the best road.
Yeah.
And he says that as a 330-pound guy that if a chef ever gave any trouble to, he would get a punch in the nose. Anyway, Peter, we want to thank you for taking the time to be on the show. Your book is great, and you can find out about more out there in listener land on our website. We'll link you right to it. How I Learned to Cook, Culinary Education from the World's Greatest Chefs.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants.
You know, during that show, we joked a lot about the kind of counterculture that still exists to some extent in the restaurant business. But, you know, one of the things that I don't think we really touched on was the fact that almost nobody who's in that counterculture either, you know, drinks to ridiculous excess or is a drug addict or all those other things. Those people generally, and almost never, and I'm not going to say never, but generally don't rise to the top.
No.
You generally don't see those people. You know, those aren't the people who you're reading about in this book. There and a lot of times they're also the people who fell into this industry because they couldn't get up early in the morning because they were hungover or
you know, it's not,
you know,
just
other problems.
It's not just that. I think, you know, it's funny because we, I mean, he talks in this book, Peter talks in this book about how a lot of the chefs take a parental role in loco parentis, mm-hmm. sort of a thing, or parental role toward their line cooks. I think,
including discipline. I mean, that's a big part of it.
But I think that you and I have had the great good fortune to do that with some of our employees mm-hmm. over the years who've allowed us to, and who, look, I can't be your parent if but there are people who've looked up to us, and I take that as a tremendous compliment, and hopefully we've made some differences in people's lives. But the other thing is we try as best we can to not allow any of that. You know, mm-hmm. when you can't make it to work in the morning because you've drunk too much, we'll tell you.
Right.
You know, and there is, it's not just that these people are losers, it's that, I mean, some people are just losers and they wind up in the restaurant business, but we don't hire them, hopefully. But the same type of person who is drawn to the adrenaline rush of restaurant service mm-hmm. is a person who's an adrenaline junkie. Okay, everybody who's good in the restaurant business, except for maybe pastry chefs, are adrenaline junkies. And
they have to like the rush to some extent, or this
who,
is the wrong business.
And people
for you.
Who are adrenaline junkies need to be very careful, especially when they're in an environment where there are late nights, you don't have to get up early in the morning, and there's a lot of alcohol.
Not to become junkie junkies.
Not to become junkie junkies. Stick yeah. to the adrenaline of the. But, you know, and it's funny, and what I have talked to a lot of people about who are in this, a lot of people who are into, like, there are also people who need that, like, special thing to put in their mouth.
Yeah, I get mine from caffeine and sugar. Thanks
well,
very much.
And I have a lot. That's why a lot of people who are in this business are into tea, are into fine ciders, or into fine coffee, or cigars. Mm. You know, it's something to do that's not addictive and not harmful. So you young people out there in the business who listen to this show, and thank you for all your emails, all of you that do, you be careful about that. Watch yourself, you know. You get on the adrenaline of hard
work. It is a dangerous road. I've seen a lot of people ruin their careers.
Get off the adrenaline of hard work. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. Peter Meehan's book is How I Learned to Cook. You can find out about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.